Hi, I'm Abra, and you're listening to the podcast for MinSpec, the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group. We meet monthly to learn more about the craft of writing. We also have a very active message board at www.meetup.com/MNSPEC. This episode is Killing Off Your Characters, Q&A with the Happy Coroner. Struggling to kill off your characters in interesting ways? Want to get the bloody details right? Never fear, we bring in the wonderful and charming Dr. Lindsay Thomas, a Minnesota regional coroner in a department that serves 8 different counties in the metro area.
And guys, let's give it up for Dr. Lindsay Thomas.
Well, I thought I would start just by giving a little of my background and then my office and how coroners and health examiners work in Minnesota, and then have plenty of time for questions. So my background is I went to Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, and I liked math and science, and I didn't like writing. So I thought the easiest the path of least resistance would be to go to medical school, because you only had to take 2 English classes to go to medical school. If I went to law school, there'd be all that writing and then a PhD, you know, the dissertation and all that. So I really admire people that like to write, because of course, as with any job, I now have to do lots of writing, but it's still not my really favorite part. So I went to medical school then at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and at that time I thought I wanted to be an obstetrician, which is particularly ironic, considering that I ended up, I totally have the wrong personality for clinical medicine, which anyone who knows me could have told me, but I didn't care for women in labor. I thought they were really unpleasant. They would swear and hit and bite. And I'm just trying to help you. I'm trying to get you pregnant. And, you know, I don't think you're going to be such a great mom anyway. So I had the totally wrong personality for clinical medicine. You know, people smoking got lung cancer, and my reaction is, yeah, like, what did you think? Because I didn't have to do a clinical internship. And it turned out I didn't really love pathology. A lot of it is looking at stuff under a microscope and laboratory stuff. And it just, you know, it wasn't that interesting to me. But I loved doing autopsies. And to this day, I've done probably 3,500 autopsies. I still love doing autopsies. I think it's unbelievably interesting. Everybody's different. To me, it's like the embodiment of the scientific principle at work, where you start with a hypothesis about what you think you're going to find, and then you do the experiment, which in this case is the autopsy, and, you know, half the time you prove yourself wrong, and I love that. I love being surprised and, you know, finding something that I wasn't expecting to find. So I then, when my husband and I moved to Minnesota, and I started hanging around the medical examiner's office in Minneapolis, and I ended up doing a fellowship in forensic pathology at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. And I worked there for a number of years, and then for the last 15 years, I've been at the Minnesota Regional Medical Examiner's Office. And we're located at Regina Medical Center in Hastings. So we're the medical examiner's office for 8 counties: Carver, Chisago, Dakota, Fillmore, Freeborn, Goodhue, Houston, and Scott. And the way it works in Minnesota is in 2006 we changed the statute so that in order to be a coroner you have to be a physician, and in order to be a medical examiner not only do you have to be a physician but you have to be a forensic pathologist. So I am a forensic pathologist, so we are a medical examiner's office. And the way it works is in each of our counties we have what are called medical legal death investigators, and those are people who aren't physicians. They have all different kinds of backgrounds. Some of them are law enforcement, paramedics, EMT, nurses, funeral directors. You know, 2 of our best investigators were, you know, they ran a photography studio. I mean, just all, you know, all kinds of backgrounds. But the sort of the key elements that are needed in a really good death investigator are obviously an ability to observe and then interpret and correctly, you know, document what you see at scenes, and a real ability to talk to people, because part of what they have to do is they have to talk to families. And as you might imagine, Many of the cases that, well, most of the cases that we're investigating, the deaths are sudden and unexpected, and so this is a very difficult time for families. So it really requires people who have good interpersonal skills, and they also have to deal with law enforcement, which takes a whole kind of different, you know, skill set. If you think about law enforcement, in every other place that law enforcement shows up, they're in charge. They're, you know, they stop your car, they're the boss of you. They are investigating a robbery or burglary, they're the boss. They get to tell everybody else what to do. But in death investigation, the medical examiner's office is equal, at least equal, and really we have more authority than law enforcement does at scenes unless it's a homicide. So it's the one place where law enforcement really isn't in charge, and so that requires a lot of, political sensitivity or something to kind of make that work so that we don't step on their toes and they don't step on our toes. So and they're the people, the investigators are the people that go to scenes. Now, in my office, if there's a homicide and the person is dead at the scene, then whoever the doctor on call, it's usually me, goes to the scene of the homicide. At homicides, we don't do as much investigation as the law enforcement do because, as Pat mentioned, I don't carry a sidearm. In Minnesota, medical examiner investigators and medical examiners are not part of law enforcement in most of the counties. And so we don't give people Miranda rights. We don't interrogate suspects. We don't chase the bad guys. We don't do any of that. That's all law enforcement. But we do obviously have to work very closely with them. So if it's a homicide, I'll go to the scene. If it's a natural accident, suicide, or something else, then it's the medical examiner investigators who go to the scene. And then, based on our criteria, they make the decision whether or not to bring the body to the morgue. So just for example, last year we had maybe 2,100 cases that were reported to our office. And I should just say, in Minnesota, the types of cases that have to be reported to the medical examiner, obviously homicides, accidents, suicides, any unnatural death, but also this huge category of unexpected natural death. So anybody who dies in an emergency room, regardless of the cause, anybody who dies at home, anybody who dies outside of the hospital or nursing home. So that's really the majority of the deaths that get reported to us are natural deaths. And most of the natural deaths that get reported to us are hospice deaths. So in hospice deaths, which is, you probably all know hospice, it's where if someone has a terminal illness and chooses to die at home, they can get wonderful in-house services. But because they're expected to die, the hospice agency can do what's called pre-register the person. And so at the time of death, then we don't send anybody to the scene. So I've always kind of jokingly said, if you want to kill someone, the easiest person to kill is someone that's expected to die. Now, of course, you don't really gain much by killing someone that's expected to die, because, you know, they're going to die anyway. If you're patient, you can just wait. But we don't go to those scenes, but we do ask questions of the hospice nurse to make sure that the medication use is appropriate and the medications are disposed of. At the scene, then the investigator will make a determination whether or not the body comes into the morgue. So the bodies that we do postmortem exams on, obviously all homicides, all motor vehicle crashes, all suicides, all unexpected natural deaths, so anyone under the age of about 60 who doesn't have a known medical history gets brought into the morgue. Deaths where it's just not clear what the manner of death is, so anybody who's in water, house fire, or any kind of fire, anything where there are injuries that may have contributed to the death, those bodies all get brought in, and then we do postmortem exams. We do a lot of toxicology, which you might imagine drugs and alcohol are the reason people end up on that table. And we also work with a lot of other forensic experts. And those people are super, super cool. And the forensic anthropologists are the people that can look at bones. And, you know, it's kind of magic what they can do in terms of giving an estimate of age and race and height and sex, gender, stuff like that. And we work with forensic entomologists. They're the bug people. Some people think what I do is weird because I cut up dead people, but I'm here to tell you that it's one of the bug people, the entomologists. Or they like maggots, which, you know, on a short list of things I don't like about my job, I have to think maggots is like way up there. The smell, nobody likes the smell, but the smell isn't as bad. It kind of, but maggots move, and so when it's an autopsy with maggots, and you immediately start feeling like, because you know, they're kind of jumpy and wiggly, so we don't care for maggots. But they do probably add a lot to the story because they make it very difficult sometimes to determine what happened because they start on a body where there's an opening, which certainly could be a wound, so they can make it very difficult. So we do about, I haven't finished the numbers yet for 2011, but probably about 450 postmortem exams. Well, actually, maybe more like 500 postmortem exams a year in my office. And most of those are going to be full autopsies, meaning that we look at all of the internal body organs and cavities, and we do toxicology and all that. Some bodies get brought in just because we can't find the next of kin or something like that, and we can't leave a body in a public place. So in those cases, we'll just do an external exam. We won't, because they aren't brought in because we need to know the cause of death. They have plenty of medical history. So then the rest of my job is signing out death certificates and talking to families and lawyers and testifying and following up on autopsies that I did, looking at things under the microscope and interpreting toxicology results and all of that. And giving talks because I love talking about my job. And we do a lot of educational things, like we talk to high schools and colleges, and it's great. A lot of people are very interested now in forensic science. It's the one outside of the whole CSI phenomenon. People are very interested, so I hope that that will translate to more people going into forensic pathology. There's a terrible shortage of forensic pathologists in the world, so hopefully, which is why I keep talking to high school students, even though like, I don't have time for this, but I keep thinking, if I can just inspire one person to go into forensic pathology, then, you know, it'll be worth it. So, that's kind of what we do, and how, the way it works in other states, and this, again, is something that you can use to your advantage in a story, is every state has their own statutes about how coroners and medical examiners investigate death. And which is kind of a goofy thing. I mean, you'd think something as important as death investigation, it shouldn't matter whether you die in Minneapolis or whether you die in, you know, Cody, Wyoming, what level of medical legal death investigation and whether or not you can autopsy, there should be some standards, but there aren't. I mean, there are, the National Association of Medical Examiners has standards, but those are totally voluntary for offices like ours that are accredited. It's great, we follow the standards, but you know, there are maybe 60 accredited offices out of the 2,000 in the whole country. So it's not very widespread, and that's one of the things I'm involved with at the national level, is trying to do that better. Yeah.
Are there any states that require more than the accreditation?
Yes, there's some really good states. New Mexico, for example, has a statewide medical examiner system. And there are states out east that have statewide medical examiner systems, meaning that no matter where you die in the state, there will be a medical legal death investigator who's trained that will come, will do the investigation, that throughout the state, the same cases will get autopsied, they'll get transported to a morgue, things like that. It's really interesting geographically how it's mostly the East Coast and then a few other rare states that have these terrific statewide medical examiner systems. And then sort of all of the West has coroners. And those are people who are elected, and it's like your local truck guy. I mean, seriously, all you have to do is like be of voting age to be the coroner in some of those rural So there are a lot of places where not much death investigation happens.
If somebody's determined to be originally from and a permanent resident of another state,
does that person...
Great question. Who has jurisdiction?
And is it ever done by both states if there's a question?
Great question. So, in Minnesota, the law is that the county where the person is found or pronounced dead has jurisdiction. So, if somebody is stabbed in Dakota County, but they aren't pronounced dead at the scene, and they get airlifted to North Memorial or Hennepin County or regions, and they die there, then it's either the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office or the Ramsey County Medical Examiner's Office who's responsible for doing the death investigation. Now, there are other states, for example, Wisconsin, where exactly the opposite is true, where the medical examiner or coroner who's responsible for the death investigation is where the county where the injury occurred. So you run into interesting situations where, for example, someone's injured in Houston County. There are no hospitals in Houston County, so they get taken to La Crosse, Jefferson Lutheran. They die there. Well, according to Wisconsin state law, it's the responsibility of the Houston County coroner, medical examiner, which is me. According to Minnesota law, it's the responsibility of the La Crosse County medical examiner. So we run into these kind of jurisdictional issues. Now, in those two counties, they've worked out an agreement that because they don't have a forensic pathologist, that if that situation occurs, we will assume jurisdiction. But you do, there are a lot of places along state borders where there isn't, you know, a tertiary care medical center or something, and the person gets transported, and the states have different responsibilities. And this, the same is true in some, just within a state, that there are some that have different rules. So it's very up in the air. It's one of the other things we're kind of working on at a national level, is to try and figure out, is there a best practice? And if so, which is it? And then how can we, you know, get people to accommodate that? Yeah.
Do you have many jurisdictional battles?
Well, we don't, because the Minnesota law is so clear, and the only county that I have where this is an issue is the Houston County, which is right across from La Crosse, and those counties have been working together for so long that we've kind of agreed, yeah, we'll assume jurisdiction. Yeah.
Does the military have its own examiners?
Oh, great question. Yes. So, okay. There is the Office of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner. And it's sort of an interesting organization because it used to be under the AFIP, which is the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, which was more civilian. But now, because that got dismantled, they are military. The people in the OAFME are military personnel. So they have jurisdiction on military bases, and but again, they tend to be very cooperative. So if, for example, in North Dakota, there's a military base, if somebody dies on the base, the Armed Forces Medical Examiner knows that Dr. Marianne Sens in Green Forks is a really good forensic pathologist. She does good work. So Marianne will talk to Craig at the OAFME and say, you know, look, there's no need to fly somebody out here. I'll do the autopsy and give you the results. But if it's, you know, Indiana or Wyoming or someplace where they don't trust the forensic pathologist or they don't have good death investigation, then the Armed Forces will fly some forensic pathologist and their team to do the death investigation. And for anybody who dies in combat, their body gets taken to the Dover Air Force Base where the where they are autopsied. Yeah.
So Dr. Thomas, we were talking about the hallway about, you know, part of what we're trying to do with this incredible stories. And so that's, in my mind, it's kind of just factoids, and it's also sensory information.
Oh, great.
And so can you give us or walk us through a... So you have a death, and the smells,
yes,
and the sensations and the appearance obviously changes as a function of time.
Yes.
Can you sort of walk us through a progression? And that, I know that it really informs me.
Oh, I'm picture, because this is one of my favorite scenes. I have a beautiful young woman forensic pathologist in my office who really looks like you know, we're supposed to look on TV. I mean, she's just... very early on when she joined our office a couple of years ago, it was during the summer, and she and I, for whatever reason, were both wearing skirts and high heels that day. This is not the norm, but for whatever reason, we were. So we got a call in the middle of the day that there was a body that had been found and it looked like it was a homicide. So the two of us, because it was her first homicide scene in our jurisdiction, I said, oh, well, let's go together and I'll introduce you to people. So the two of us show up in our skirts and high heels. And we walk in and the cops are like in those Darth Vader gear and they've got their tie back and they're, you know, they're like... And we walk in and say, well, what's the deal? Well, the bodies are really decomposed. It just smells terrible. And they I love this because they're all these big cops with their, you know, breathing. And they're sticking their heads out the window. And Emily and I just kind of walk in and we go and we look and there's one stinky dead body. And then we go and we look and there's another stinky dead body. And we're like, oh, yeah, okay, great. And then we leave. Initially, they are, you know, body temperature, they're, depending on if they died a natural death where they were starting to kind of dwindle, they may, you may already have some rigor actually starting to set in, you may have some, which is the rigidity of the body, you may have some livor mortis, which is the settling of the blood, just because that has to do with gravity and heart, you know, pumping. And as the heart slows down and blood isn't pumping as much, it will start to settle. But most of the cases that we're going to be dealing with are people who were healthy prior to being dead. So within a fairly short period of time, the blood will start to settle. And that is based on gravity, because once your blood's no longer being pumped, then the blood will start to settle. There are a number of things that affect...
Could you say the word for that?
It's livor, L-I-V-O-R, mortis. M-O-R-T-I-S. And it's also sometimes called
lividity.
Yeah, that's
what we hear on the TV.
Yeah.
Castle.
Yeah.
Castle is lividity.
So that's that, and that has to do with gravity. And there are certain situations like carbon monoxide poisoning and cyanide and cold that make the lividity look red. Now, obviously, if you have someone with darker pigment in their skin, then you can't assess lividity as well as in people with lighter pigment in skin.
It's blue otherwise.
And it's sort of a purple blue, yeah, because the blood isn't oxygenated anymore because it's not, you know, the person isn't breathing. So otherwise, it's kind of a purple blue. And it settles, but not in areas where there's pressure. So if you think about when a person is, say, you know, lying face down, there will be pressure on their nose and their chin, and so those areas will be white, and the rest of the face will be dark. Or, you know, if their arm is here and they're lying, there will be this sort of white, spirit area where the lividity has formed around it. So lividity is not super great for time of death, but it can be useful for determining the position the body was in. Because after about 24 to 36 to 48 hours, the lividity becomes fixed, meaning that even if the body moves, it stays in a certain position, it will stay in whatever position the body was in up to that point. So if, for example, a person dies or is killed and is left in one position for a day or so, day and a half, 2 days, and then they decide for whatever reason to move the body to dispose of it somewhere else, you will see lividity in the pattern that the body originally was. So that's one of the early changes. And then the rigor mortis sets in and that's stiffening. And again, that will happen, a person doesn't stiffen and the muscles move, the muscles will just stiffen in whatever position the body is in. So, and you don't really stiffen against gravity. So if you see someone that's lying down and their arms are stuck like this, you know, okay, well, they must have been moved after rigor mortis formed. So again, it's rigor mortis or rigidity are the two words there that are interchangeable. So then after that starts in a couple of hours, sometimes sooner, there are a lot of variables. And then within a day or 2 days, that starts to go away. So if you find a body that's let's see, cold and stiff, you know, they've probably been dead less than a day. If they're cold and flaccid, meaning they don't have rigor, then they've probably been dead less than a, more than a day, because the rigor has come and gone. If they're still warm and they don't yet have rigor, then that means they've been probably dead less than, you know, 4 to 6 hours, because the rigor hasn't formed yet. We don't take body temperatures. There are places that do that, but I think it gives a erroneous sense of precision, because I don't know what your body temperature is or your body temperature. We don't know what a person's starting body temperature is. So yeah, we could do a thermometer in the liver and say, yeah, their body temperature is 92.6, but we don't know where they started. And we also don't know to what extent their body fat, the clothing, what the, you know, there are too many variables. So we just, you know, feel the body is cold, or the extremity's cold, but the center's still warm, or is it cold all? So those are some of the early things. And up to that point, we're still perfectly happy, you know, it doesn't smell that bad. You know, it still looks like a person, it still looks like the person who died. So, and then it really depends on primarily the temperature of the environment. If a person dies outside in Minnesota in the winter, they can stay days and days and probably weeks if there's no animal activity, and they'll still look pretty good. Now, I've had bodies pulled out of freezers that, you know, were tucked in the freezer for a variety of reasons, and you pull them out and they look great after months and months in the freezer. But they will start to decompose very quickly because the rest of the process has started already. But if somebody, for example, is in a warm environment outdoors in the summer in the sun, they can start to decompose within hours, really. So the way decomposition starts is it's due to bacterial action. And we all have bacteria in our gut, our bowel. And it's our cells being alive that keep the bacteria in the bowel. But once those cells are no longer alive, then the bacteria have free reign. And then they crawl through the walls of the bowel, and then they start to do what bacteria do, which in gut is primarily made gas. So initially, what you'll see in a body that's just starting to decompose is you'll see green discoloration over the appendix area, the right lower quadrant of the abdomen. And the reason for that is your cecum sits for 99.99% of us in the right lower quadrant, and it's closest to the skin. And so the bowel is starting to decompose, and the bacteria are crawling out and making the pigments that they make, but the place that you'll see it the first is the right lower quadrant. So sometimes you'll see a body that's still in pretty good shape, but it'll have this green discoloration, and inexperienced people will think, oh, it's a bruise, you know, it's a green, like, healing bruise or something, but it's just decomposition. So then, as decomposition goes along, you'll start to get skin slippage, which is just the epidermis, the upper layer of the skin, will start to slough off. You'll start to get what's called marbling, which is, if you look at a living person, you can kind of see their veins, and but in a dead person, you don't see that as much because the veins sort of collapse because there isn't blood pressure holding them up. But there's still blood in the vessels, and with decomposition, the red blood cells break down, and then the pigment that's in hemoglobin leaks out, but doesn't go very far. So then you'll see kind of the outline of the vessels on the body, and that's called marbling. And if the environment is dry, you'll also get mummification of the fingers and toes. And if it's a really hot, dry environment, like a desert or something, you can get mummification of the whole body. And that preserves the body pretty well. In that, if you go that route, it's more desiccated than decomposed, so it doesn't bloat, it just shrivels up and dries. So then you'll start to get, with the gas formation, you'll get bloating, and typically that starts in the abdomen. For men, it's also the scrotum. Also the face will get start to get some bloating, and that's the point at which then visual identification can become difficult, because you've got discoloration. As it goes on, the person becomes darker and darker, and with real decomposition, the, you know, Caucasian person looks African American, are really darkly pigmented. and they'll be very distorted because everything is just swollen and stretched. Now that too, along this continuum, is when things start to smell. And it's sort of a cross between stool and rotting meat. If you think about the bacteria in stool, it's kind of like that, but it's more than that. It's also that kind of, you know, when you open something and food that's kind of bad. So that's kind of how I think.
How long did it take to become accustomed to that smell? I mean, because you said you don't really react to it.
Right. Well, nobody likes the smell.
I didn't say you liked it.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it's just, you just sort of get used to it. It's kind of, I'm sure there are people that, for them, that would be a deal breaker, like they chose not to go into it. I mean, I consider it really job security, because if it weren't for decomposition, everyone would want to be a forensic pathologist. It's like the best job in the world. So I kind of appreciate decap, because it's sort of, that we could use some more. But.
So you don't resort to, like, you know, oil, clove, or things like that?
However, there is some really good stuff. It's called Noxo, N-O-X-O, and you can look it up online. It's that and Vicks are what the cops use. We don't let students use it, but if we have cops, we let them use it. We do a lot of training with cops, and we had a woman recently who, oh my gosh, she just kept stuffing them. I don't care if the way Vicks
does.
And they weren't even really decomposed bodies. She just, I mean, the thing is, when you're doing an autopsy, and, you know, once you open the body and it does start to smell, and especially if you pop the bowel, which I inevitably do when I'm opening the body, or when you're taking the bowel out. I mean, it just, you know, it doesn't smell great, but it's like, you know, it's not that bad. So, and with decomposed bodies, we just kind of do it really quickly. And then as decomposition goes,
I was just wanted to ask a little bit about when you're talking about mummification.
Yes.
Like area of the fingers. Or potentially the mm-hmm. whole body. Does that look? What does that look like? Does it look like a mummy?
It does. Okay. The person becomes really shriveled and leathered. I mean, okay. The skin looks like leather, and that's the challenge in doing those autopsies. Is it's really hard to cut through the skin because it is. It's like.
And how long does that process take? Is that a progression where you could maybe kind of tell?
We don't see it that much because our hot is a moist hot. So probably somebody from, you know, New Mexico or Arizona would know better. It is a progression. I mean, it does start. We do see it with fingers and toes, sometimes with legs and arms. It probably could be used to some extent to determine, you know, timing. Yeah.
If someone's stuck up in a chimney. Will they be smoked?
A chimney that's being used? Well, that's interesting. Because it's a confined space, so you'd have a hard time really bloating much. And I guess, yeah, the smoke would kind of dry them to some extent. So, yeah, you'd kind of leathery from it. Yes?
When I was in high school, I was in Seattle, and there was a curio shop out on the wharf, and they had a mummified person in a glass case that had been found in New Mexico, and they didn't know how old he was, but based on what he was wearing, and he had a six-shooter or something on him when he died, they figured he was from, like, post-Civil War, but he did look...
Like a mummy?
Yeah, he had red hair and mustache and stuff, and that was all the same color, but his skin was...
Yeah, just leathery flying around. Well, and I should say another form of decomposition occurs, and this is more common in Minnesota, in when somebody goes in deep water, where the skin kind of like turns to a sort of soapy, and I'm blanking on what it's called right now. It's called something else. Saponification is what the skin does, but it'll come to me with the...
Is that when the body fat turns into the...
Exactly, right.
I remember it's called.
But it can get really calcified too, so they can become like almost they're in cement, like the skin can become really peculiar. So that has happened in bodies that are in really cold water.
I know you got sent some questions. Do you remember what those were?
Well, one of them was how do you kill someone without anyone knowing, which if I knew, I would tell them. You have to figure that people weren't very smart because they got caught, you know. I mean, we recognized it as a homicide. So, I know, yeah, my answers to those are probably not very satisfying. Yeah.
Just to change the direction a little bit, what's the most inept attempt you've seen someone make at covering up forensic evidence?
Well, it's usually someone who's committing a suicide that then is trying to make it look like a homicide or an accident. That's the more common. My experience with homicides is people rarely go to much effort to conceal it. It's usually, you know, I wasn't there and didn't do it, rather than it wasn't a homicide in the first place. So it's more in terms of sort of pretending that, you know, someone's trying to break in or the setting up a gun case to make it look like someone was cleaning their gun and it went off. Find a nickel for every one of those, you know. Which I suppose you could have a homicide also, set it up to look like the gun was being cleaned. But as forensic pathologists, we're fairly suspicious of gun cleaning deaths. You don't really buy this as an accident.
Yeah. Is there any double check of your work? Couldn't you get away with?
See where I'm going. Well, that's a great question. And
you fooled us all. You realize.
I had a question one time where somebody asked, you know, sort of, what's the who checks on your work? Because it really is like the autopsy is kind of the end of the line. I mean, it. It is sort of what I say, you know, it is. Now, the sort of on a regular basis, we have other forensic pathologists in the office. I'm never doing an autopsy by myself. There's always an autopsy tech. If it's anything suspicious, law enforcement is also at the autopsy. So from that perspective, I would have to be very clever to, you know, make an autopsy look like something other than it is, because I wouldn't be doing it myself. But there is a legitimate problem, not so much forensic pathologists attempting to cover something up, as just more often attempting to help law enforcement with solving a case and sort of nudging the evidence or nudging the findings to be, oh yeah, that's the sign of two people having been involved in stabbing, when it's like, as a forensic pathologist, you can't say how many people stabbed this person, you know. So that, and the kind of the balance for that is that when a case goes to court, the defense always has the option of hiring their own expert to look at a case. And so I know when I'm doing, especially a homicide autopsy, but really, you know, a motor vehicle crash might end up going to court if it's a wrongful death. I know that there may well be another forensic pathologist who's going to be reviewing my autopsy. And so, our minister today was talking about how bad it is to be a perfectionist, and I was thinking, okay, yeah, but you don't have a job like I have, where if I say something happened on the right leg and it was really the left leg, and I'm sitting in court, the defense attorney or the attorney is going to say, well, Dr. Thomas, if you didn't even know which leg was the right or the left leg, how can we trust the whole rest of your autopsy? So I have to be a perfectionist. Does that sound offensive? It's not perfectionism, it's just accuracy. So there is a built-in in that way in the system that it does require good defense attorneys, though, to recognize that there may be a problem with the original autopsy. Yeah.
How does an autopsy proceed?
Oh, good fun. If it's a homicide, we start with, at the scene, the body gets zipped in a body bag and sealed, so that no one can tamper with the body between the time it leaves the scene and it gets to the time of the autopsy. So then we unseal it, and we start with photographing the body just as it is. The one thing that we'll do at scenes is put paper bags over the hands, sometimes, depending on the case, but, because lots of times in homicides, the hands are really important to look at to see if they're defensive injuries or whatever. Fingernail, little aside, during a homicide autopsy for the 25 years I've been doing this, I've been clipping the fingernails, of the homicide victims on the outside chance that the defendant or the perpetrator's DNA is going to be, well, I started prior to DNA, but now that their DNA is going to be under the fingernails. And it's one of those things that, like many things we do, it's like, okay, I do this because if I don't do it, the defense attorney's going to say, well, why didn't you do it? Knowing full well that it's completely worthless. Except that I've had two cases in the last couple of years where the defendant's DNA was under the dead person's fingernails. So it's like, wow, that is a powerful tool to say, there's no way that guy can say, I wasn't there. I mean, your DNA is under her fingernails. So we do bag the hands of homicides, but not regular cases. So we document everything, and then we'll remove the clothing. And again, if there's evidence, particular evidence on the clothing, like hairs or fibers or gunshot residue, we may actually have removed that at the scene or remove the evidence at the scene, because a body that's leaking blood in a body bag kind of makes a mess of the clothes. But assuming the clothes are still on the body, then we'll remove the clothing and document those separately. And then we'll photo the body as is. And then at that point, we'll photo the hands as is, and we'll clip the fingernails. If there's a question of a sexual assault, we'll do a sexual assault exam, which involves taking swabs, oral, anal, vaginal. If there's what looks like semen or anything on the skin, we'll swab that. So we'll collect all of that evidence. Then we put the body on the autopsy table, and then we'll wash the body, because obviously when there's blood and stuff, it's hard to see the injuries sometimes. So then we'll wash the body, and then we'll photo again. And then we'll document every injury with photography as well. And then I'll dictate the external exam. So I'll dictate the clothing, any property that's with the body. My external exam dictation describes the height, weight, clothing, hair, color, eyes, rider, liver, injury, and then injuries, all that kind of stuff. And then that usually is the longest part of the autopsy, is the external exam in a homicide. Because with a homicide, you have to document every scratch and every, bruise, every single thing. So that's a lengthy part. And that's the most variable part of the autopsy, because if you have someone with no injuries and, they took a drug overdose or something, and there's nothing externally, that part of the exam goes really fast. But if it's a homicide where you're doing clippings and, photoing and counting 119 stab wounds, that part of the autopsy can really take a long time. Yeah.
I have a question about bruises. So I picture bruises as something that takes a while to form. And so if there was an assault and someone was injured in a way that would lead to a bruise, but they died before the bruise fully formed, does a chemical process continue on that would then cause the bruise to appear later? Can you talk about that?
Right, and actually it's not so much a chemical process, it's simply physical leaking, because what causes a bruise is that the vessels under the skin are torn. And so over time, blood will continue to leak out. But it follows the same rule as lividity, so it will primarily only leak if it's in a gravitationally dependent area. So sometimes, though, if we do think, especially like the strangulation, sometimes you don't see any bruising, but if we do think that there may be bruises, we'll actually save the body, like after we do the autopsy, and wait a day, and then look again on the skin to see if some of the bruises have shown up better. So, yeah.
Favorite scene in films, the body waking up in the morgue.
Yes, it's happened to me. Day as a forensic pathologist, if that happens.
Possibility.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would say most of the time that I've heard of that happening, it's been in places probably that don't have the kind of level of emergency medical care that we have. Where
ducks.
Yeah, I mean, our EMTs are pretty good at listening for heart, checking pulse. you know, people, medical people know that if the body's really cold, it came out of the water, that you can't assume that they're dead until they're warm and dead. I'm not saying it could never happen, but I don't think it's very likely.
It probably wouldn't happen in an urban center.
Right, where people know. So just to finish up on the autopsy part, so then we do an internal exam, and we do the routine Y incision, which is shoulder to chest, chest to pubic bone, and then we peel back, and what you see is the skin and fat, and that's very variable, and then muscle, and then the sort of lining of whatever cavity it is. And then, then you have the rib cage exposed and the abdominal organs exposed, and then really we use hedge clippers to cut the ribs because they're cheaper than medical tools and they work very well. So then we remove the chest plate, and then we can see the heart, the lungs. So then if we still need heart blood, I mean, if we still need blood, then we'll get blood from the heart. But before we open up the body, we usually get specimens for toxicology, which is vitreous, which is the fluid in the eye, blood, and we usually get femoral blood and urine. But if we haven't been able to get any of those outside, then we'll get those once we open up the body. And then we'll just start removing organs. So we usually start by removing the heart, the lungs, bowel, and then all of the abdominal and pelvic organs. And then we make an incision from ear to ear and peel the scalp forward and back. And then we use a vibrating saw. It's like a cast cutting saw. It doesn't cut skin, but it does cut the bone. And so then we'll do kind of this cap cut, take off the top of the skull, and then remove the brain from the inside. And then the last thing we do is the neck. You have to cut the optic nerves that connect to the back of the eyes, and then you have to cut the vessels, and then you cut the spinal cord, but then you get the cerebrum, cerebellum, brainstem, all of that. And then the last thing we do is the neck, and the reason for that is because in strangulation it can be very subtle, the amount of bleeding in the neck, we always want to make sure that we've drained all of the blood from the chest cavity as well as the head. And we put the body up on the chest block so that the head sort of tips back, and then to do the head, we put a head block under it, but then when we're done with the head, we tip it back so that the blood drains that way, and that way so that there's no pressure on the vessels in the neck. So that if we cut a vessel in the neck, blood won't come out and then artifactually make us think, oh, there's, you know, injury in the neck. So then we, from the underside, so the flap of skin is like this over the face, we come up and cut on the undersurface of the tongue, and then being very careful not to cut the carotid arteries because that's what the funeral directors use for embalming the face. And then we remove the neck organs, including the tongue and the hyoid bone, which is the bone that gets fractured sometimes in strangulation. We look at each one of those organs separately. We weigh them. If there's something abnormal, we need to take a picture and examine them. And then we take a microscopic section of each organ to look at under the microscope. And then we'll look at the cavity. We'll look for pelvic fractures, clavicle fractures, rib fractures, sternum fracture, and skull fractures, and document any injuries that way. So only thing that's variable, sometimes we'll do x-rays if we're looking for bullets, we'll do x-rays ahead of time. If it's an infant or child, we'll do x-rays looking for bone fractures. And I think that's about how an autopsy goes. Yeah.
Are you surprised?
Well, what I love is natural disease, so which I know. So it's really a treat for us when we get to do an autopsy on someone that didn't like doctors and didn't go to a doctor, and so has something that shouldn't kill someone, like, you know, a ruptured gastric ulcer. We get super excited about that. You know, I know it's not that interesting point of view, but it's just so interesting because you shouldn't die of stomach ulcer. I mean, there's medicine, there's surgery, but, you know, people who don't like doctors aren't going to go see a doctor, then they end up dying suddenly. And so that's the kind of thing that we get excited about. A ruptured aneurysm, we do this kind of, oh, I got a ruptured aneurysm. There's sort of this real competitiveness among the forensic pathologists in the office. Oh, you got a ruptured myocardial infarct.
Do you have, like,
based on the fact that you figured it out and nobody else knew, or?
It's that there are actually very few things that are the cause of death in this. And so when we find the cause of death, meaning that it isn't just heart disease, which is normally what we find is heart disease, and it's like, okay, if we rule out everything else, then great, they died for heart disease. But when we find a ruptured heart attack or a ruptured aneurysm or pulmonary embolus or, you know, one of the kind of handful of a stroke into the midbrain, a brainstem, when we find the cause of death, we just get super excited. And it doesn't happen that often. And plus, as I mentioned earlier, I love proving myself wrong. So I love starting out a case thinking, oh, it's going to be, you know, heart disease or whatever, and then finding something unexpected. That's kind of what keeps us going.
Do you have, like, bingo boards that you're filling out?
Colleague at work has gotten 2 ruptured heart attacks. It's so unfair. I haven't had 1 in years.
And, just going backtracking for a second to the autopsy, do the organs go back?
Oh, yeah, good question. So once in a while, we'll save an entire organ. We might save the brain if it's a homicide where there's brain injury, because the brain has the texture of, like, tofu. So when you cut it, it's kind of holds together, but not great. And it really looks like tofu. I used to say jello, but somebody said tofu, and it's like, no, it really is tofu. Yeah, that's much better. But you think I might do that. So what we'll do is we'll save the brain in formalin, and then we have one of the people in my office is also a neuropathologist, which is somebody who specializes in brains. And then she'll cut it with me so that we really document everything well. Or once in a while, we'll save the heart if we think that we need a cardiac pathologist to look at it. But most of the time, we just save little pieces to look at under the microscope. And then everything else goes back into a white plastic bag and goes into the abdominal cavity, chest cavity. And then we loosely sew the skin up and put the skull back and sort of lap the scalp back on top of it, and then we wash off the body and then put it back in the body bag, and then it goes to the funeral home. And at that point, the family has the option of, they can have the body embalmed, and they can have a full open casket service, and unless somebody has, you know, facial injuries that prevent that, but or the, you know, the family can choose to have the body cremated or whatever. Yeah.
With all that you talked about taking the organs and stuff, how does donor policy fit in with that?
Oh, great question. So we are super, super supportive of donation. There's sort of 2 different types of donation. I think what most people think about donation is organs, like hearts and kidneys and liver and stuff like that. And the only way a person can be an organ donor is if they're brain dead, but their heart's still beating, and that's really, really rare. That's for the motorcyclist that's not wearing the helmet. That's for the suicide that doesn't quite get the brain the first go round. So it's really rare that somebody is brain dead but their heart's still beating. But in those cases, the organ donation agency has to call the medical examiner's office to get permission before they proceed with donation. Because if it's a homicide, we just want to make sure that somebody is documenting the injuries. So once in a while, somebody from the medical examiner's office might actually go and watch the organ harvest just to document what injuries there are. Since that's so rare, it doesn't really happen that often. What happens on an almost, more than daily, a couple hundred times a year, is tissue donation. And that's things like eyes, like the corneas, skin for burn victims, heart valves, not the whole heart, but the valves, bones, connective tissue. And we are very supportive of that. So the way that happens is our investigators will ask the family if they're willing to talk to a donation agency. And if they are, then the donation agency will talk to the family, get their permission, and then we work out the timing. So if it's a homicide, it's very hard for the person to be a tissue donor because the timing almost never works out, because we can't really let them go before we go and collect the evidence. But there have been a few homicides where, you know, they were killed in the early morning and we did the autopsy during the day, and then they hadn't timed out yet, so they could still be a bone donor or skin, some eyes, something like that. But often what happens is the donation agency then will take our photos for us, they'll collect our specimens for us, and they'll go ahead and remove the bone and skin and heart valves and things like that, and then we'll do our autopsy after the donation has occurred. Yeah.
How long would it take to process this entire thing, and how long would it take for the... You always see the police, in the time it takes the police to drive to the coroner's office, they've done everything, including the forensic results. And
I know, I'm so jealous of those people that get their results like that. Yeah, no, in the real world it takes more than 54 minutes. So, how long an autopsy takes totally depends on injuries. In that, if, like my favorites are drug overdoses where they didn't inject, they just swallowed pills. Because, and in somebody that's fairly young, that isn't obese, and that hasn't had surgery, those will take less than an hour from start to finish because the external is really quick, there's no injuries to describe. The internal organs, everything's normal. It's just a matter of collecting specimens and ruling everything out. So those take, you know, less than an hour. The other end of the spectrum would be the woman who was stabbed 119 times, where the external exam, you know, took two forensic pathologists, 6 hours just to document, describe, draw, photo every single one of those wounds. So the whole autopsy was 8 hours for the two of us. I mean, there were two forensic pathologists in there for 8 hours. And we also had all of our assistants and everybody else. So, it usually, I'd say the normal autopsy is a couple hours. The normal homicide autopsy is probably 3 to 4 hours.
Toxicology reports, how long that?
So, at our hospital, we have a lab that does urine drug screens, so we get our urine results that afternoon, which is beautiful. If anything's positive or if we want to do blood tox, we send it to the Hennepin County Toxicology Lab, and we get those results within a week. Unless it's benzodiazepines or something weird, and then it takes about 3 weeks. The other end of the spectrum is if we send to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which has a toxicology lab, and in that case it will take 6 to 8 months to get the tox results. And so we only do that in homicides, but we still send a half it because I need to sign out a case sooner than that. So we only use them just so that they'll have to testify if they have to. Yeah.
When I talk to somebody from the St. Paul Police Department, I believe that he said St. Paul has their own lab.
So a lot of the bigger jurisdictions like St. Paul and Minneapolis and Hennepin, maybe Ramsey, have their own crime lab, but none of those do toxicology. The only sort of crime lab that does toxicology is the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Somebody else know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So when you're doing the external exam, you have to document every single injury, even if it seems pretty unlikely that it was, you know, in any way related to the death. I'm just thinking, like, I have rambunctious cats, and
I have
a nasty slash on my leg. So
yeah.
If I ended up in your
trouble,
you would have to.
I would describe that. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if it's a motor vehicle crash where my description may be on the order of on the anterior upper left leg in a 13x9 cm area are multiple contusions individually ranging up to 3 cm. You know, it might be that. But in a homicide, I would probably say 5 cm above the left knee is a 3 cm purple red contusion. And 4.5 cm above that is another, yeah. So this is why I prefer people without injuries. Yeah.
So do you measure these, or is it just estimation?
No, I got a ruler when I'm doing my autopsy, and I measure the scars.
So a spine ruler type, or
a what?
A flexible ruler?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if for some reason, like I'm trying to do a gunshot pattern or a bite mark or something like that, we also have those square, you know, those right edge rulers that, so you can
Yep.
Make sure that it's really a right angle when you're reproducing as well.
Yeah.
During the external examination, do you ever have issues or feel highly challenged by identifying bruising on people who have been tattooed?
I would say anything that interferes with the skin color makes bruising challenging. So probably more than tattoos is people with darkly pigmented skin. And so in cases where the skin is darkly pigmented, where I'm really suspicious or concerned about bruising, I'll actually incise the skin so that I can see if there's bleeding in the underlying tissue. So that would be more common in, say, infants or children where we're concerned about child abuse. I wouldn't do that in most cases where I have, you know, other injuries, but that is a problem. Not so much with tattooing, though that's, you know, actually the great thing about tattooing is it really helps with identification. So even decomposed bodies, you can still see the tattoos, which is what I said to my daughter when she got a tattoo. So I'm not a fan of tattoos. That one's easier to identify a decomposed body.
There's typically scenes on television or other show where someone's been stabbed to death and there's copious blood flow. Mm-hmm. And eventually, of course, the heart gives up. And because you're in sort of a sack of fluid, there's some leakage that's going to continue on. Can you describe how quickly or how copiously a person might continue to bleed after death?
Sure. So how much a person bleeds at the time of injury really depends on where the injury occurs. So, for example, if someone is stabbed in the chest and it hits their aorta, they may not bleed very much externally because you can fill up, you know, you can put 2,000 or 3,000 cc's of fluid in your chest cavity before it starts leaking out. The sort of the opposite of that was a case I had, a homicide where somebody was standing fairly close and shot someone in the chest with a shotgun, and their heart essentially exploded and actually splashed heart blood directly on everything that's nearby. So the heart will continue to pump until death, and so as long as the heart's pumping, blood will continue to come out of whatever openings there are. After death, again, it really depends on gravity. So if the stab wound is on the front of the chest and they're lying on the back, then blood really isn't going to leak out. It's just going to leak internally, as opposed to if they have the thing we see the most, probably the scalp lacerations, where someone is lying in the body bag and they have, you know, a 1-inch scalp laceration that happened at the time they had their heart attack or fell over dead, and you open the body bag and there's like, you know, 2 cups of blood in this bag, and you're thinking, what on earth? And it's from this little bitty laceration that's just continued to leak just because of gravity and the force of the blood, just blood pressure, but not from a pumping heart, blood pressure, just from the pressure.
So is there a difference in how blood would clot then?
No, there isn't. And the blood in the body stays liquid for a while, and then it clots, and then it dissolves again. But unfortunately, that doesn't seem to bear any resemblance to anything useful. It just happens, and then it goes away, but it doesn't help with time of death, or cause of death, or anything, as far as I can tell. Yes?
What about, like, burn victims? How does that change?
Oh, so the thing that's so interesting about burn victims is you look at a burn victim and, you know, they're fried to a crisp. And you don't see an inch of skin. And you think, well, this is going to be worthless. You're not going to get any useful information from this body. But in fact, once you sort of cut through the crispy outside, you can get amazing information. Especially those of us that are well padded, because, you know, it takes a long time for the fire to get into our internal spaces. We open up those bodies, and the organs are all small because they're kind of cooked, and the heat will make them shrink. But we can still get blood, we can look at every single organ. We can see if they've inhaled soot. Now, that only is up to the point where, there's still some semblance of the body. I mean, I've certainly seen bodies that were burned beyond the point where you could get blood or see any organs, where it's really just down bones. So in that case, that makes it very challenging when a body is that badly burned. What we can do is do carbon monoxide levels on muscle if there's any residual muscle. And the reason we do carbon monoxide on burn is if their carbon monoxide is high, then we know they were alive when the fire started and they died because of the fire. If their carbon monoxide is low, then we know they were dead when the fire started, and therefore we're very suspicious that they were killed and somebody set the fire to conceal the body. So burn victims up to a point are except for the fact that you can't see anything on the skin, so we don't see bruising, we don't see external injuries, but internally we can get almost full information. One of my favorites was somebody that was stabbed in the chest and then set on fire. And so initially doing the external, I didn't see any injuries. Did the blood carbon monoxide, and it was low, 2%, so I knew, okay, they were dead when the fire started. And then once I opened them up, I could see the stab wound from the inside, and damage to the heart and the blood and all that. So, yeah.
You had mentioned taking samples and putting them under the microscope. What are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for infection. So in the lungs especially, I'm also looking for pneumonia, but it could be myocarditis, inflammation of the heart, it could be hepatitis, inflammation of the liver. I'm looking for evidence of scarring to suggest old injury, so a previous heart attack. I'm looking at if there's a growth that I'm going to see, is this some kind of cancer? So a lot of times, like a motor vehicle crash or a homicide, those micros are really just jumping through the hoops. It's just we do it because we do the same thing every time because we have this routine so that, you know, when I ask, well, doctor, did you look at the left adrenal gland? I would say, yep, I know I did because I always do. So in most trauma cases, the micros are not particularly useful. It's more useful in natural disease, diagnosing natural disease. So sometimes, you know, I'm going to be looking at a gunshot wound. All I want to see is there's soot. To see if it's an entrance or exit or range of fire. Yeah.
You mean about spontaneous combustion? I have read an article that said it is possible. There's a wicking effect between body fat and clothing, and you can have a body burn up and not affect the surroundings.
Oh, that part is true. So the spontaneous human combustion, there was recently a coroner in Ireland, which says a lot more to me about Ireland than it does about spontaneous human combustion. Who ruled that, in fact, yes, this person did die of spontaneous human combustion. Now, the fact is, most of these bodies that you see that appear to have spontaneously combusted, oh, by the way, they were cigarette smokers, and they were intoxicated. It's like, okay, let's think about a good fuel source, yeah, alcohol. Let's think about a good ignition source, yeah, cigarettes. My favorite are the people who are on oxygen because they've spent so much time. One hand and a cigarette. And it's like, you couldn't create a better environment for her. So, in terms of the spontaneous part, I think there is actually, it doesn't just that you're just sitting there and oops, burst into fire. There is an ignition source. But the thing that's amazing is you can have a body that will burn and there's smoke and soot damage, but there's no other, you know, the couch even that they're sitting on is intact.
Yeah, the article that I read said they more like smolder than
actually
ignite.
Right, they don't really, you know, but you're right, it's the wicking, it's the fat dissolving and sort of dripping on that makes, you know, as it. It's like a candle, that's it exactly. Yeah.
So, with all the injuries that you talked about, what do you do with the strange weapon injuries? I mean, all of the TV shows are, oh, it must be such and such.
Right.
Well, how do you tell what it was?
Yes. And that is one of the temptations as a forensic pathologist is to pretend that we know more than we do. And it's really, it's, you know, everyone in the room is saying, well, doc, what do you think it is? And, gosh, who hasn't had the urge to just make up shit?
Especially with this audience.
But forensic pathologists have that urge, too, because, number one, this is a sad story. Somebody's been murdered. You want to figure out what happened. There's a human impulse to, you know, help. And you, these cops are your colleagues, and they think you're really a big deal because you're the doc. And, so there is this pressure to sort of say, yeah, well, what'd you find when you interviewed the suspect? Yeah, I think that does look like a tire iron. Sure. Yeah, that's like a tire iron. Yeah, that's a tire iron. So those of us who try to, you know, tread a higher moral ground, we don't really get that creative. What our job, as I see it, is to say to the people who are responsible for the investigation, tell me the story, and I will tell you if the evidence fits the story or not. And what this is one of the things that kind of drives me nuts about, you know, the CSI kind of thing, is that the forensic pathologist is always the person that comes up with the story. Like, I'm working backward. It's the Sherlockian sort of, it's the bad fallout from that, where it's like, okay, I'm going to look at this body and I'm going to tell you what happened, and then you're going to go and prove me wrong or right, you know. That's not how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be you tell me a story and I will tell you whether the physical evidence fits or not. So now, having said that, you know, I've seen a fair number of hammer to the head injuries. So if I see a circular skull fracture surrounded by a scalp laceration with a circular abrasion, I'm going to say, okay, you know, yeah, this looks a lot like a hammer. So when you're doing your search warrant at the scene, you might keep your eyes open for a hammer that has some blood here on it. You know? But I wouldn't say, oh, this is a hammer injury. So likewise, when we have sort of an unusual pattern, we're going to document it really well. We're going to then say to law enforcement, you know, this is a pattern that is consistent with something. Tell me the story. And if they say, well, they fell down the stairs, it's like, no, I don't. Tell me another story. okay, well, they, you know, I mean, a great example of that was this woman who had these round, absolutely circular round bruises. And it was like, okay, showing the scene photos. Well, she was an alcoholic who fell all the time. And the railing on their stairs had one of these sort of filial things that was totally round. And it completely matched. I was like, okay, so every time she gets drunk and falls over on the railing, you know, she gets... So that's sort of how we do it, is we say, this is the pattern, this is the size, this is the shape. Show me photos from the scene. Tell me what the suspect says happened, or, you know, and then we work forward from there. We either say yes, it fits, or no, it doesn't fit. But we try really hard not to create a story working backwards. So, yeah.
Kind of along the same line, how much of a difference is there, let's say, between a screwdriver and a knife being used both in a stabbing?
Oh, well, so sharp force injuries, like with a knife, they cut the skin, but they don't abrade or scrape the edges because it's a sharp force injury. Mm-hmm. A screwdriver is, the center part will look kind of like a sharp force injury, but the edges will be abraded or scraped because it's more of a blunt impact as it goes in. So, now, obviously, you can have screwdrivers that are really thin, that are closer functionally to knives, and you can have knives that are really thick that, you know, end up looking the same. So, it's why we would never say, oh, yeah, this is absolutely the implement that caused this injury. We would say, yeah, it's more consistent with a screwdriver than a knife or something like that.
So you don't stab a lot of pig bodies?
No, although, you know, dead animal abuse back in the day. One of my favorites was we had this guy who we thought his body had been set on fire after his death, and so we were trying with lighter fluid. And so we bought these two turkeys, these dead turkeys, no, turkeys. And then we put up flannel shirts on them both. And one of them was lit on fire out in the parking lot, the other one we dribbled lighter fluid and lit that on fire to see. It was kind of a failure, as Yes, your arm looks like him. Yeah.
Happy Thanksgiving.
So I hit a pig head with the butt of a gun one time because I was again trying to recreate an injury on somebody that I was pretty sure they'd been hit with the butt of a gun. And so we got a pig head that we hit that didn't work very well because pig skin is enough different. But. Mm.
So in other words, if somebody, you know, you're watching an episode of Castle and they say, this person looks like they've been stabbed with a replica of the Washington Monument.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly. Yeah, which is why my children will no longer watch any of the shows with me. For a while, she wanted to be a surgeon, so she and I would watch it. And she then finally just said, Mom, I'm not going to watch it. It's not fun because you're always going, that is not how it would be. You are not allowed to do that. That is so immoral and unethical. It's just so.
But it's television.
I know, it's so
awesome. Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it is motivation, isn't it? I mean, as writers, we have to think about motivation for characters. As a ME, you probably have to have. Think of motivation that you're open-minded. You like to disprove yourself.
Exactly.
Everybody
does. No, and that's so the key, I think, of being a good medical examiner or forensic pathologist is to be open-minded. And we kind of have this joke that if a body is transported from one place to a certain office, that if it wasn't a homicide by the time it left, it will be by the time it got but that's, I mean, it's sort of the ongoing challenge that we have is to stay open-minded and not to jump to conclusions. Okay, so I will tell you a story of an example of when I didn't do that. I was a burn victim. So I was fairly badly burned. The story is this woman is out of town and she's trying to get a hold of her husband and she can't, and so she calls the neighbors, you know, we can go check on Joe, and they go and check on him, and the house is burned and he's dead in the fire. So it comes in, you know, here's this middle-aged man and he's got a history of whatever. So I do the external exam and I cannot find a penis or scrotum or testes. And I'm thinking, well, okay, he is pretty badly burned. I've never seen it where I couldn't find a penis at all in a fire victim, but, you know, there's a first time for everything. So I do this entire autopsy, persuading myself, well, it's a guy. I mean, he came in, the story is it's a guy. I'm thinking it's a guy. And it isn't until I'm going to remove the bladder, and it's like, where is the prostate? That I finally say, okay, stop with the assumption that this is a man. Take a step back and acknowledge what you have been subconsciously seeing all along, which is those are labia. Those are not just some kind of burned scrotum. And so I said to the investigator, okay, we need a little more history. Please call his wife and ask, is he really a man? And so the investigator called him, a woman and said, oh, well, no, actually, you know, he was going through sex change. I mean, he had his breast removed, but he hadn't done the penis reconstruction. He had a hysterectomy. But he lived as a man. Everybody in this town thought he was a man, but no, actually, he was a woman. But to me, it was like such a wake up to how your assumption about what you're seeing totally colors what you see. I mean, so I tell this now to every fire marshal that comes to an office. Did Kevin tell you about the case that I said? Because I just want people to know that it's so powerful, our expectation of what you're going to see.
When
so,
you assume.
Yes, exactly. You know, that makes it even me, so. Yeah.
Have you ever watched a show or read a book where they did get away?
You know, the very first Patricia Cornwell, I thought she started out well.
Started out well.
Yeah, I mean, she got the biggest thing I don't like about those books is that they show the forensic pathologist chasing the bad guy, and that's the piece. That's like, we don't chase the bad guy. The bad guy doesn't come and act. You know, that just. We are not law enforcement, and it's really, really important that we're not law enforcement. We're totally independent law enforcement. But I thought kind of the medical stuff in her first couple books, I thought she, I mean, she did work at the Virginia ME office, and I thought she really...
Well, people shot her Jack the Ripper solution full of money.
Well, actually, I kind of liked the Jack the Ripper book that she wrote. I thought that was kind of intriguing.
But they shot it full.
I know, but, you know, that's... It's unsolvable at this point, so it's anybody can have a theory. But I kind of liked hers. Yeah.
Are there any particular books that you could recommend for us to find out more?
This is an incredibly boring book unless you are passionate about medical examiners. But it's called The Postmortem. And it's by Stefan it starts with a T. It's like Timmons or
is it
Stefan, it's like S-T-E-F-A-N or something. And it was his PhD thesis. And he's a sociologist and he spent a couple of years hanging around a medical examiner's office. And it's a fascinating book about how we really think and sort of what our strengths and weaknesses are. And I like Mary Roach, Stiff, is that her book?
Yeah.
Stiff. And then there's another one, Body or something. Again, it's nonfiction about kind of what happens to bodies after death.
The Body Farm?
That's a good one. Yeah, there are the some that are written about the facility in Tennessee. Adipocere. Oh, thank God, I'm losing my mind. Adipocere is a kind of decomposition that occurs when saponification happens.
How was I supposed to get on that one?
So you talked about what the body goes through in a normal environment. Would you like to speculate someone in a spacesuit?
Oh, yes. Like what would happen where there isn't gravity?
And it's high oxygen content but low pressure. And if it's a punctured suit, there's soon no pressure.
Yeah. So what happens to bacteria in that environment? Do we know?
I don't off the top of my head.
It really depends on what happens to bacteria in that.
Yeah, it's aerobic or anaerobic.
Well, it's mostly anaerobic bacteria in the gut goes wild.
The soil would become its own biosphere in a sense.
But you're right, if there's no oxygen, then but anaerobes would be more than happy.
But you'd have oxygen for a short period of time, definitely.
Right.
And it's possible that the tank would hold for an hour easily. Because you've got a puncture, so it isn't like it all...
Right, it all goes away. Yeah. I would think it would pretty much... I mean, you wouldn't get lividity because if there isn't gravity.
Okay.
But the bacteria are still going to react to having no living cells protecting them, I mean, keeping them in the bowel. And they're still going to be able to multiply and view the body as food source. So
until they run out of oxygen.
Right. Although the anaerobic bacteria are going to be super happy being there. So I think probably it would go a lot the same, as long as it's in a place that has pressure. I mean, I'm like in a capsule or something. I mean, if you're in zero pressure, then I assume the body just kind of explodes and drifts apart.
It doesn't explode. It wasn't accidents. It was done on purpose by scientists during World War II. They did tests on living subjects. And it's not like what you see in the movies where the body ruptures or anything.
Really?
We're only talking one atmosphere difference.
Yeah, they used to talk about the blood was boiled and all of that.
Yeah.
That's how it is grouped.
Well, I suppose that's true. It's not like it's negative.
The body probably would dry up a lot quicker because water doesn't want to stay liquid in a vacuum.
Right, and because it's very cold and dry there.
Or very hot.
Or, yes, mm-hmm. Very hot, right.
If you're in the sun, it's very hot.
Yeah, so more like mummification, I guess. Yeah. Great question.
Going back to the turkeys, do you ever do the kind of weirdo experiments they do on bones to figure out how somebody was killed?
It's happened once in a while. Right now I have a case where I'm trying to, I mean, it's not a weirdo experiment, but I'm just trying to figure out range of fire, because the suspect says that the guy was holding the gun and playing this game, and we think somebody else was holding the gun. So we're just, the VCA has the gun and the ammunition, and we're just going to go and test fire at different ranges to see if we can recreate the injury pattern. You know, I mentioned beating a pig with the butt of a gun because I thought that was the injury. But I mean, we do some, but not a lot. Yeah.
Actually, talking about that, you mentioned the pig skin is removed from human skin. How exactly is it different?
Well, the challenge that we had was that pig skin is a lot thicker than human skin, and the hair is much coarser. So it doesn't, it's fine for probably things like gunshot wounds, because you have a really high force that's, so, you know, it replicates pretty well in that way. But just for a blunt impact, it didn't react the same way. I mean, you can lacerate, you can cut the scalp pretty easily with a, with a blow, and you couldn't really get the scalp into the skin to tear the way human skin would. So that's the main problem with that. Yeah.
So what happens if there's only bones? Do you still see this, or?
So when there are only bones, we call Sunmeister, who is the forensic anthropologist at Hamline University. And if she has a class, they all come and help us. Some of my fondest memories are the whole forensic anthropology class down in a basement in Houston County, where somebody found some bones, and so we ended up essentially excavating their whole basement and sifting sand. So we'll go to the scene if it's something suspicious with her, because she can tell by looking, you know, do we have all the bone parts? Is this a piece of stick or a bone? And then we'll bring it back to our office. If there's any flesh on it at all, it comes to our office, and then we'll clean it. If it's just totally bones, she might just take it to her office. Although if it's a homicide, it would probably come to our office first, just so that I make sure that we document everything that needs to be documented from an evidence standpoint. But then she'll be the person that will sort of do the measurements to help determine the age and gender and race and height and types and stuff and all that kind of stuff.
All right, we should probably do the last round of questions, because we've been a lot, at least 15 minutes between this and the start of the routine group. So I know Conrad has one in the back.
All right, great.
I have heard of something called a death moan or a death rattle. Could you tell us, is that true, and what is that like?
So no one has woken up, but people have made noises in the morgue. And what the way I think of it is that there's still air in your lungs when you die, just because of the recoil, the way our chests are configured, our lungs at rest are more open than closed. So when we move a body, if we put pressure on the chest, then the air gets forced out through the lungs. And so I think probably there's some element of that as people are preparing a body, maybe, you know, washing it or whatever, that any pressure on the chest or even the abdomen to some extent can cause air to come out through the mouth. And I think that's kind of what that...
That actually happened with me. My dad died, and when we were moving him to move him out of the bedroom, that's what happened. We shifted his body and he...
It's a little eerie. I mean, when we're moving bodies, we're reaching the end. I'm sure when it happens that close to death, it's like, what on earth? But it's just that, you know, the vocal cords are sort of nearly closed because air gets forced past and it makes them the same sound as air going through them anyway. So,
I was actually wondering, how many forensic pathologists work in your office?
Well, global perspective, there are only about 500 forensic pathologists in the whole country that are board certified full-time forensic pathologists. So in Minnesota, we're very lucky. We have almost 20 forensic pathologists. And in my office, there's me, and there's one person who works 2 days a week, and one person who works 1 day a week, because very sadly, my main assistant just moved to Texas. So she's working at the office of Fort Worth. So I will be hiring a full-time forensic pathologist in July. And there are 4 full-time forensic pathologists that have been, and they also have a person in training. There are 3 in Anoka, there are 4 in Ramsey, there's 1 in Duluth, 1 in Hibbing, and 1 in Rochester. And then there are a few who are retired, mostly, but still in the state.
So if somebody goes to school for this, they can pretty much be guaranteed a job?
Yes. Oh, yes. At the moment, there are jobs all over the country. Yes.
When you guys get together, you must have jokes. What's your favorite?
We just stuck up sea water dasher.
Gosh, I'm really bad at remembering jokes. But lacrosse medical examiner is really good. Whenever he shows up, he's always got a new joke. I can't remember any of them.
You went on vacation and your work piled up on your desk.
Oh. Oh, I hope that.
What is your inbox like? Where do they keep these things?
Yes. Well, one of the challenges actually in our office is we only have space for 6 bodies in our cooler. And we desperately need a new office. We're sort of in the process of trying to figure out what that will look like. But that is
the problem. So what do you do when you have like a gang murder or something? There's like a whole bunch of people, bodies who can kill all at once. It's like a big homicide. A really big homicide. How do you deal with all those extra bodies?
Well, 11 is the most bodies we had in our office in 1 day, and you just, you put them wherever. We're very fortunate that we have a really good working relationship with the Hempen and Anoka medical examiner's offices. And if we had a mass disaster of some kind that required additional people, we would call them and come and help.
The shock value in TV and movies, you always see the medical examiner with like a meatball sub in one hand. Does that really happen?
Honestly, it did used to really happen, not so much with food as with smoking.
Oh.
I can remember, I am old, but I can remember doing an autopsy at Hennepin County one time where the person was exhumed, and you talk about bad smells, exhumation is a bad smell. And so one of the forensic pathologists who was just there to observe, wasn't participating, sat in the corner smoking a cigar, because it was like, we all kind of appreciated it. But that was before we wore face masks too, which I have always worn gloves, though I've known people who were my predecessors who said, you lose so much sensitivity with the gloves, and I'm like, I've heard that before.
So.
Yes, exactly. Dr. Koch got hepatitis because he was back in the day when they didn't love him. We're very careful because mostly hepatitis C is kind of the thing we are most worried about.
Because it's forever, even on death.
Exactly. It lives forever, and a lot of people don't know they have it, and a lot more people have it than you would think. It's silent epidemic kind of thing. HIV is sort of a vulnerable virus, so it doesn't last that long after death, so we don't worry so much about that. And partly the populations that I cover don't have a particularly high HIV rate, but there is hepatitis C in all populations, so we're much more careful.
Did you ever interact with the CDC for...
Yes! Oh my gosh, they are so phenomenal, and the Minnesota Department of Health is great, too. So we kind of interact with the CDC through the Minnesota Department of Health, but they have a wonderful surveillance program for infectious deaths, or deaths due to infectious diseases. So whenever we have one of those, we collect specimens and they send them to the CDC, and yeah, they're a terrific resource in the Department of Health. Any other questions? This is so fun.
the question about the death rattle reminded me, what's up with bowels and bladders releasing on death? Does that
you know, it does sometimes and it doesn't sometimes. And it's not universal. So it's one of those things where everybody thinks that it happens all the time. And sometimes it does, more so with bladder than bowel. But it doesn't always. We most of the time get urine. So even if the bladder, the sphincter loosens, it doesn't completely empty the bladder. So I don't really know. You'd think that would be a useful piece of information, but as far as I can tell, it's not.
What percentage would you say?
Well, most people have urine. Probably more than 75% still have urine. So it's... But a lot of times at the scene description will be, the clothing had urine on it, or the bedding had urine or something. So I think that happens fairly often. But.
So it might be a matter of how much pressure is in.
Yeah, and maybe that's it. How much the bladder is under pressure. I don't know.
Well,
yeah.
One last question, which fatal injuries don't necessarily cause the person to fall over immediately and stop moving. Can you talk a little bit about that? How long, and obviously depending on what the injury is from.
Right.
The back end of the heart probably doesn't last as long.
Right.
But you still could.
So at the opera last night, the guy shoots himself. I thought the storyline was in the forehead, but to me it looked like from the blood on his shirt. He shot himself in the belly. He then proceeds to sing for the next, 25 minutes. Okay, excuse me, Francis Paul. Storyline. Yes, which was fantastic. It was a great opera. But as my husband and I were leaving, even my husband said, the death scene went on. So if somebody has, and this is usually either in a motor vehicle crash or a gunshot wound, if they have an injury to their brainstem, that is pretty much lights out. And they will literally drop. And heart rate stops, breathing stops. That really is pretty much instant death. So if you are a sharpshooter and you're trying to take someone out, make sure you hit the brainstem because that's really what you want.
So not any headshot will do that.
Not any headshot will do that. No, many headshots will not. In fact, a lot of suicides,
sometimes,
especially if they're this way and they sort of just take out the front of the head, but they don't angle it back.
I
don't
know somebody who did that.
Oh, it's like that's just
he lost his job, part of his nose.
Yeah, it's just okay. If you didn't want to live before, you really probably are feeling about now, but. So gunshot wounds, injuries to the chest, people can do amazing things after they still have an injury to their chest. I was at a scene once where a guy had a shotgun wound, which when we did the autopsy turned out to hit his heart. And this is where it obviously happened because this is where the casings and everything were. And he was like more than a half a block down. I mean, so he was shot and ran almost half a block. Now he was an otherwise healthy young man and, as long as you have some blood flow to your muscles and brain, you can keep doing things even if you no longer have any heart pressure. Most injuries, it does take several minutes because most injuries, the sort of mechanism of death is internal bleeding or, bleeding to death. And that does take several minutes for that to happen. Yeah.
In the movie Gladiator, the villain stabs a Russell Crowe in the back, and that's supposed to be a fatal wound, but not an immediately fatal wound. How realistic is that?
How long was the knife? Oh, okay.
It's been a while since I've seen it.
So, what they were aiming for was the aorta or the inferior vena cava, which you can get to if you come sort of through the back and at a slight angle so that you avoid the vertebral column. But the aorta and the inferior vena cava sit on the front side of the... And if you cut one of those, especially if you cut the inferior vena cava, especially in gladiator times prior to medical intervention, a person would very slowly bleed to death internally. But the vena cava would be several minutes, maybe quite a few minutes.
Okay, so how realistic was it for Russell Crowe to, in turn, kill the guy?
Oh, that is totally realistic.
Okay.
Actually, because with the stab wound, either more so to the inferior vena cava, but even to the aorta, It's not going to be an instant death. I mean, you'll still have a couple of minutes, and that's all it takes to, you know, swing around and stab somebody. Yeah.
When you do an extubation and the body hasn't been embalmed, is there a long, I mean, if it's been years since the death, can you still obtain information from that body?
If the body has not been embalmed, most of the time, after a number of years, it will just be bones. And you can get information from bones, but limited information. If the body's been embalmed, it will be there in some form or another for 30 years. I mean, it's the longest one I personally have done was 25 years. And it was very badly embalmed because she was decapitated and set on fire, so they had a hard time doing the initial embalming. But she still had plenty of gooey organs left.
Why would they embalm somebody who'd been decapitated and set on fire?
Well, they were trying to sort of preserve what they could. But that was the worst smell ever. That's what they say.
There's some laws about when you have to.
Right.
If they lie, whether the...
Whether
it makes sense.
Right, and actually in that case, I'm sure they didn't bury her right away because they were probably hoping to find a path to bury with her. So they may have kept her, you know, body down for a while. And then after realizing, okay, I guess America find the head, we'll just have to bury what we got.
I
want to
thank you for it.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to the Minnesota Speculative Fiction Writers Group podcast. The MinSpec podcast is produced by Aberstaff and Wiebe, recorded and engineered by myself, Conrad Zero. Whether you're an experienced writer who wants to help others, or an aspiring writer who wants to make your writing better, join us on the web at meetup.com/MNSPEC.